Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read. The cow goes moo.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is André Debut III. He's the author of House of Sand and Fog, a rather remarkable novel published by Norton, and two other previous books. Now, The House of Sand and Fog is a book that, in a way, brings an ethnicity into American literature. A good half of the novel is narrated from the point of view of an Iranian family. And I wondered about the background and preparation for bringing such a family at the center of a novel.
Mm-hmm. I tend to work really intuitively. I try not to plan ahead too much or really know what I'm doing, because I think the imagination thrives when we really haven't got a clue. I've been fortunate enough to befriended some Iranian people over the years and count some of them as some of my best friends. My imagination was captured by the situation of a man I knew who was a retired Iranian colonel in the Shah's Air Force. And he sort of came in organically. And when he came, I had to make the decision to either tell it in a sort of distanced, omniscient point of view or from the point of view of the other. And I thought I'd really take a leap and just try and be him. So with great terrified feelings, I dived in.
Mm-hmm. Are there problems, do you feel, in, you know, people now find it sort of amazing when a male writer speaks in the voice of a woman or vice versa. In this case, for the first two-thirds of the novel, you alternate between the voice of a woman, a recovering alcoholic and addict named Kathy, and the voice of the Iranian colonel, new in America. So in other words, you're taking on an alternate gender and an alternate culture. Mm-hmm. Are those things that you're wary of? Do you feel that there's a usurping that goes on when that attempt is made?
Not at all. I really think it's our job description. I think the job of the writer is to imagine the lives of others. And I know that that whole politically correct debate, I think there's some well-intentioned people behind it, but I think they're greatly misled. I think the writer Rose Ellen Brown really said it best. She said that, you know, when we put ourselves in the shoes of the other and imagine with great, hopefully great empathy, what it might be like to be you, it's really inherently an act of friendship and not colonialism. The risk, of course, is we get it terribly wrong and fall flat on our face, but that's the risk we take. So, no, I think it's frankly our job.
Many people regard your father, André Debut II, as one of the most impressive living writers of short stories. Do you feel that you inherit any special liabilities or abilities as a writer by being a writer's son?
That's a good way to put it. I don't know. The honest answer is I'm not sure. For a while, it just felt like one big liability because there's a real shadow thing that goes on. And what feels sometimes rough and burdensome is to be sort of immortalized as the kid. And, you know, I've got three kids of my own, and after a certain time, you stop feeling like the kid or the son. That's been the hard part. But I think the good thing is, and I try and look at this in the positive way because it is largely a good thing. First, I love and respect and admire my dad, and we've always been close. He's also one of my favorite writers. If he wasn't my father, I'd have all his books anyway. You know, he's wonderful. And his work's going to last hundreds of years after his death. I think one thing, though, looking back, that he did give me without my realizing it at the time, when I was a little kid, I would see a grown man go into a room and shut the door to try and make something out of scratch that somebody else might be moved by. And I think at a deep sort of level, I sort of felt that that was an okay option as an adult. And I didn't realize that until I became a writing teacher in a writing program and saw that a lot of these people didn't start until they were in their 40s and 50s because they had parents in other fields of endeavor who would not take that seriously to go write a poem or a short story or anything. So that's been a good. Oftentimes, people understandably lump us together, and I do think that if my name was Ralph Johnson, no one would ever read my books and read his and put us in the same conversation. But
what
I'm
do
sure,
you take to be the primary difference?
Well, I'm just beginning to think about it. It seems to me, and I'll tell you why I'm just beginning to think about it. I try not to think too much about other writers when I'm working on my stuff, whether they're my father or not. Because, you know, there are a lot of shadows out there. And I think God doesn't put creativity in us to compare each other's drawings. You know, if you look at little kids, they don't all of a sudden compare until the big teacher comes in and messes it all up and throws gold stars at people. So I try not to get into that creatively. But I will tell you that because I've been asked that recently, I've been thinking about it. And I think that there are some big differences. One, my father's a man of religious faith. He's a very devout Catholic, and I grew up deeply ambivalent and confused. I'm not a church-going Catholic. That's a big difference. And I find that I tend to write – I read it, actually in an interview he was talking about – he said, you know, I tend to write about people who don't have God in their lives. I've always wondered what it's like not to have God in your life, so I tend to write about them. And I thought, well, what about – hey, I don't have him either. So I think I tend to write about people who don't have him either, but from the point of view of someone who doesn't. Uh-huh. Although that's changed, and I have to say that what's changed for me is having children. I really have completely let go of this godless idea.
Now, in the book, though, there is the sense of a world that seems to have tumbled beyond the reach of God's ability to save a situation. This is a very tense, nose-to-nose human situation in which the Iranian couple are inhabiting a house that they've bought. They believe that it was simple, you know, put on sale by the county at auction for non-payment of taxes. Mm-hmm. It turns out that this was a bureaucratic error, and yet the sale has been completed. And so two sets of people are yearning for this small house in Northern California. Not a very valuable one, just a bungalow, but it becomes the place where everyone, the battlefield for everyone's dreams. Mm. But it would seem at a certain point normally that since there is no legal backing down, that a matter of faith or sense of morality would resolve this, but none of the parties are able to seek action in correctness.
Yeah, well said. You know, my reflection on that is I hoped it would go better. I did not set out to write a story that ended tragically or that was even particularly dramatic. I began in the point of view of the colonel and then in the point of view of Kathy, the ex-homeowner, and I was prepared for it to be a hopeful story maybe. I was hoping that they would reconcile. I was hoping that at some point, if they ever met in the narrative, they might sit down and have a sane moment. But things did escalate, and one of the things I think that trouble me and kind of fascinate me about life is just how little of a push we need over the edge for things to really spiral out of control. In an afternoon, you know, a blown temper with a child, road rage. It takes about three little details in an hour to turn a day on itself. And I think about the difference, and I think this might be a Buddhist concept, the difference between reacting to something and responding. And I do think the three characters in the story, primarily Kathy and the Colonel, find themselves reacting more than responding. And I think it's a particularly American way of life to react and to not respond. And not to denigrate my culture. I love this country, and I'm glad to be writing in this country. But it's not without its illnesses, and I think that's one of them.
How does the issue of the house resonate for you?
That's a good question. Personally, artistically?
Mm-hmm.
Both?
Yeah.
Artistically, I very early on in the writing of the book, which took 4 years to write, I felt I had the recipe for real conflict and maybe drama on my hands, which felt sort of invigorating. Personally, I think I've always been haunted by home and what home is and what it is not. You know, I've never lived in a house that my family owned. I don't own a house. And it's a curious thing to me, how we define home and what home really is. And sometimes it is a piece of property. Other times it's not. I think in the case of Kathy, that little bungalow is not so much everything as what it represents in her family, and the fact that it was her dead father's house, a father who never really approved of her. I have to tell you that as a father of young children, I simply want big walls around my house. I feel a huge nesting instinct, and I've never wanted – the word home has never meant more to me. And I think that came to bear on the writing of this story as well.
Now, eventually, as in I think the second of the Rabbit books, a family is being held hostage in this novel. Oddly enough, it's in Rabbit, it's a white family. Here, whites are holding an Iranian family hostage. In particular, a policeman and an addict are essentially – well, it's a very complicated hostage situation in a sense because the girl has gone back into her own home, now dispossessed. She attempts suicide there, and then – she is found by her lover, a policeman, and much of what goes on is about domination, who has a right to what, who has surrendered the right to what, and how to surrender. You know, no one can surrender in this situation.
Right, right, right. While you're describing that so well, I think of Aristotle's line in the Poetics. He talks about what defines character, and he says that, you know, man is his desire. And that was very informative to me. I learned a lot from the desires of these characters in that moment. But one thing that kept coming up for me that I noticed as they came out of my pencil over the years is fear kept coming up. That one of the things they kept reacting against was their own fear. And then in a large sense, their fear of how they're doing, say, of how they appear. A lot of that was fear of how they appear was fueling a lot of the destructive impulses.
Well, prisons seem in a way important to you. The first collection of stories is The Cage Keeper. And again, it who is holding who prisoner? And, you know, how does the morality of oppression turn the tables? What interests me is that what results is a narrative structure in which there are only potential wrong moves and no clear right ones. And removing positive actions seems to be the job of the writer in your work.
That's so depressing. It's so depressing, Michael. Well, I can – that's really interesting. I can tell you I haven't consciously removed them. I know what you mean with my first book. There's the – in the main – the title character, the title story, excuse me, the Cage Keeper, a prison guard counselor is kidnapped by an inmate, and he is the jailer, and the Cage Keeper kid is the jailee. And again, I didn't purposely set out to see what happened with that, but once it happened, I was glad to go for the ride to see what happens. I guess, you know, Flannery O'Connor said in her essay, The Nature and Aim of Fiction, that our beliefs are not what we see, but the light by which we see. And I think it's – I learn a lot about myself after I've read something I've written. And I think you're onto something about only a wrong turn can be made. I think I may be personally haunted by how wrong things can go.
Yeah, it's sort of as if the book begins after the point where the expulsion from Eden has happened and now there's only sin.
Right.
There may be havens. People can buy houses and hide for a while, but as soon as they interact, there will be a confrontation that will make it impossible to continue to be quiet, to continue to be human or lead a meditative life. And it seems as if the frame, at least in this book, House of Sand and Fog, by my guest André Debout III, is the family. The family is the prison. All of these people have great debates about what they mean by home. They are all in various degrees lying to their families. Kathy has not told her family that her husband has left, that she's lost the house. All of the colonel's business moves are concealed, largely because he feels he's done nothing wrong and has nothing to explain. And the field instructor, the policeman, burden. He has been living a life within his family that doesn't include him. He's there but absent from them persistently, almost as if because his wife, who has been involved in social issues, is asking him in some way to participate in the issue of the family, but he has no side. Mm-hmm. It's almost as if this book, which makes him the perpetrator for the most part of catalytic action, is to force him into the wrong move. He's so busy being a moral man, which in your work seems to be a neutral man.
A moral man is a neutral man?
Yeah, I think that here the goal ultimately is for both the writer to be neutral. These characters would all be fine if they did not take a side.
Yeah, interesting insight. I do think I think you're onto something. I tend to write about, now that I think about it, I tend to write about characters who do not have a very set belief system, a religious faith or a real philosophy. And those that do, as in The Cage Keeper and I think Les Burden to some extent, it's sort of a quickly picked up set of rules and regulations from a pamphlet that they're still searching. And I do think that we are more vulnerable to suggestion and reaction when we're floating like that. I guess.
Well, it's not my intention to be personal here, but only because I saw it in the book and it was so enormous to me and in a way fascinating that the book poses again and again the problem of allegiance and repeated on every side, do I go with daddy or do I go with mommy? A kind of replication of divorce seen in every direction, almost as if the child will remain safe as long as he or she remains neutral. But the moment the decision is made to move away from this marriage toward that marriage, to obey mother rather than father, the simmering starts to happen. So I wondered.
I'll jump in on that. I do come from a broken home, interestingly enough. And it's not interesting. It's terrible. And for all those listeners who've been through it, either as from the point of view of the parent or the child, it's terrible and nobody wants it. I was 10 when my mother and father divorced. And I lately, as a father of young children, I have come to feel more poignantly just what that has done and not done. I sometimes get skeptical or combative, what's the word, dubious. I start to argue the seeds of creative venture. I don't really know what starts stories. And I sometimes prefer to stay in the dark about what causes the mystery. But I will say that I think we can trace these things to the artist's childhood and to certain trauma. And I think you actually describe perfectly a reality that I recognize.
Well, no, I think you describe a reality that I recognize.
Oh, good. That's my job.
and that is to say that can you only write about what you know? Because I notice here there's a decision, it seems to me, to stay with working class people or at least people who've been placed in the working class. Is that by inheritance or choice?
By inheritance, what do you mean?
Are you a member of the working class and these are your people?
Well, see, it's a weird thing. I was talking to my wife about this. I am and I'm not. The only real job I've ever had is a writing teacher, which I only started doing about 8 years ago. The jobs I've always worked are blue-collar jobs. You know, I've been a carpenter for 15 years. I've been a bartender and truck driver and cook. Now, I went to college. I got educated. But right after I got out of college, I started writing. And I didn't want to get a job that gave me benefits and an identity and a tie and end up writing on the weekend. So, and I also grew up in working-class neighborhoods. I mean, all my buddies were from blue-collar homes. And so I realized I didn't really meet a middle-class kid, you know, like the son of a dentist, say, until I went to college at age 19 or 20 in Texas. So yet I wasn't working class either. My father's a writer, and even though he didn't live with us, we had books in the house. My mother was a social worker. So I'm one of those people who is not either one. You know, I'm not. I don't feel a part of the middle class. I didn't grow up comfortable, but I'm not really a blue collar kid either. But
well, this is what I mean about that neutrality.
Yeah, I am in another world.
You do not want allegiances.
Yeah, I that's a good point. I don't know if that's good or not, Michael, but I think you're nailing me.
No. I hope I'm not nailing you.
No, nailing as in I think you're capturing the truth about it.
Now, here's my idea, though, and it's I think it's peculiar. In the language of self-help and personal growth, characters, people, are told that as long as they stay neutral, they're going to stay blocked. They have to start taking responsibility and making choices. And I found the tension in this novel on its inner level as being not between the characters but between the author and his refusal to judge and the characters who are being forced to make a decision at long last.
Interesting. I love what Hemingway said. I don't know the context of this line, but I quote it a lot, and that is, the job of the writer is not to judge but to seek to understand. And I think the tough part there is seeking to understand. For me, I'm very committed to knowing these characters. It's problematic for me to – I think it's artistically dangerous. It feels hazardous to me to start to push my own hopes and wishes on characters. I'm very committed – what I try to do in my work is let them be who they are. What I'm hearing you say, though, and I'm intrigued by, is that you're not sure I am. Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's put it – as a decisive statement. In The House of Sand and Fog, the things that these characters are being forced to want are things that you're very reserved about. To make a commitment to a particular line of action, to keep the house or to surrender the house, is very complicated for a writer who perhaps has never really lived in a house until you find, by a process of creative discovery, what is in fact the home for you. So it's as if a whole world of inner decisions are swarming under the surface of the House of Sand and Fog. And I like that quality. I like it a lot more than the decisive battles, the sense that on the one hand, a writer is being very wary about how to present these Middle Eastern characters. How are we going to engage the prejudices that are almost essential when we get the sense that, I mean, they're being called Arabs on all sides, and they are speaking Farsi. You learned a bit of Farsi to write the novel. Right. There's that tension. How do we present prejudice without ourselves being prejudiced?
Yeah, well, I guess the reason I quoted the Flannery O'Connor line is I think you're really capturing a lot of, the triple relationship here, the relationship between the writer and the characters and the reader ultimately the writer. And I do think that I learn a lot from hearing from people who've read this book, and I learn more about myself and the process and what it is I've made here in this book. First, of course, I know you know this from the book, but Persians and Arabs are different.
Mm-hmm.
I also like that inner tension. I'm also skeptical when I write from their point of view. When I'm writing from the point of view of Lester and Kathy, I know there's more at stake than just the house. It's not just the house. And there, hopefully, I also think one of the jobs of the writer, if we can do it, if the alchemy comes together, is to really explore the gray.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where most of our drama occurs. And this is a particularly externally dramatic story, but most of our drama is not so dramatic. It's in these gray little ambivalent layers of our lives. That's where the real battles and demons and dragons are. And what I tried to not do was to surrender to the external action of the story, which got to be pretty heated up in the story, because there is some ambivalence on all three sides about what they're really trying to do here. All three of them, and I felt I sort of breathed an artistic sigh of relief when they started to show this, all three of them have ambivalence about why they're working so hard towards this thing. How about if I just do this and back off here? And then other things come in. What I'm hearing you suggest, and I'm wondering if this is true, is that what was coming in to push them more towards the house was me Mm-hmm. Was I the author? Is that what you're suggesting?
No. Rather that you are questioning the whole nature of a house and whether it's valuable.
I am. And lately in reviews, the phrase American Dream has been raised. And that is something I have really consciously wrestled with my whole life.
Well, you know, to end, what is a house of sand and fog?
Yeah, good question. Well, you know, my editor, Elaine Saliano Mason, was the one to isolate the word sand and fog for me, and we helped put the title together. And in doing so, I have been contemplating the fact that that novel is full of sand, in both, you know, literal and figurative, of course, the sand of Northern California, the sand of Iran, where the colonel comes from, this sort of elusive quality of sand. As a carpenter, I can tell you it's very hard to build a house in sand. It's rough. It looks like it's going to stay, and then it'll completely sink into the thing. So there's this an illusion of solidity, and it's not. Fog is, I think, what we're all up against. I frankly think that's our challenge. How to live clearly, how to be aware in the moment, how to be true to what is without reacting but by responding. And, well, actually working through this novel, that's one question that's clearer to me now. Although sometimes it feels pretty foggy.
living with bewilderment, would you say?
Yes. I love that phrase. There's a wonderful book called The Writing Life by Annie Dillard. I don't know if you've read. Brilliant little book. Little, I mean short. Not a small book. And she talks about Giacometti and how Rico Le Brun talked about Giacometti. The reason he discovered such great things in his drawings is that he had the courage to persist with his bewilderment. Frankly, that's why I go to the desk and try and write these stories is I am frankly bewildered most of the time. One of the things I tell my students, especially younger students, is it's okay not to know anything. I think we have this cultural idea that writers are supposed to know things. Well, no, I think it's important that we admit that. Well, I'll speak for myself. I feel as if I know very little. And that's why I write. The writer Tim O'Brien said in this wonderful essay, The Magic Show, that writers tend to be the kind of people who, quote, want to enter into the mystery of things. And I find the deeper – isn't that great? I love that. Uh-huh. I love his stuff too. And I find that the deeper – the more honestly I write, which equals the more deeply it seems, all I get is bigger questions, which are exciting and terrifying.
I've been speaking to Andrea Dubue, the third author of House of Sand and Fog, published by Norton. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. My engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Development by Beverly Walker. And editing by Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book. Of the mouse,
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.